Welcome back to another week of Behind the Lens. I'm Debbie Elias, film critic, creator, and host of Behind the Lens, where we go behind the lens and below the line with the movers and shakers, the film and TV and streaming makers, those producers, directors, writers, actors, cinematographers, film editors, sound editors, mixers and designers, production designers, costume designers, VFX gurus, composers, casting directors, stuntmen, authors, and more. And as you all know, I always love to talk film and cinema. So much so, it's often quite difficult to shut me up once I get started. So, the morning after, the night before, everyone adjusting to the time change in the U.S. as we sprang forward and lost an hour of sleep or work on Saturday night, Sunday morning. I always hate that. Sometimes tough for the body and mind to adjust, which is why just chilling, kicking back, and watching movies or binging a series like Monarch Legacy of Monsters is a surefire cure that will get you raring to go with daylight saving time. Now, speaking of Monarch Legacy of Monsters, how many of you are watching Season 2 on Apple TV? Two episodes in, and it's high-octane fun, and who doesn't love seeing Kurt Russell? I highly recommend Monarch, and of course, you can binge Season 1 to catch up if you need to, and this is a series I suggest you do binge Season 1 in order to fully appreciate the story at this point of Season 2. Speaking of Apple TV, no season 3 of Palm Royale? A travesty. A travesty, to be sure. Not pleased about it. So, Apple better really dazzle me later this year with the next season of Silo. And of course, I'm in Yellowstone mode. Two shows in on the next year of Yellowstone with Marshals, starring Luke Grimes as Casey Dutton. I am loving this show, although it's not quite as emotionally intense as Yellowstone, which I attribute to Taylor Sheridan only executive producing and not writing this series. However, this week's episode involved the infamous Yellowstone train station. All you fans out there, you know what I'm talking about. So, I'm not giving away spoilers, not when it comes to the train station. So if you missed the show on CBS last night, Sunday, catch up now on Paramount Plus. And if you missed episode 1 last week, you can catch up now on Paramount Plus. It is a solid series. It is good. It is action-packed. I love Casey stepping into this role as a U.S. Marshal. It's a little more elevated than being a livestock agent, but it mixes law enforcement with cowboying, and it's fantastic, and the locations are beautiful to watch, and the supporting cast is good, and of course, as I mentioned last week, Mo Brings Plenty is back, thank God, Gil Birmingham is back, yes, and Brecken Merrill is back as Casey's son, Tate. So, I'm happy. And of course, Brian Tyler and Brett and Vivian are responsible for the music in every episode. So, if you haven't checked out Marshals yet, do it. You will not be disappointed. If you haven't checked out Monarch Legacy of Monsters, oh, hell yes, go check that out on Apple TV. But now, on to today's show. I love this week's show. And my interview with writer-director Paul Boyd as he talks about his new film, Scared to Death. Paul is fantastic. Scottish-born, worked in the UK, based in the UK for a while, based in US now, in LA area. He is just fantastic. He knows his craft. He knows how to tell a story. He started his career directing music videos for about 30 years. And among them, if you think back on music videos that you have watched over the past 30 years, in MTV's prime days of glory, mind you, you know Paul's work. He directed 10 plus Shania Twain videos, including her biggest hits. He did multiple music videos for INXS, Tina Turner, Lenny Kravitz, Bryan Adams, the Backstreet Boys, and so many more before moving into feature films. Paul has a very distinguished and skilled pedigree, and now he brings us Scared to Death. And I have to say, I had so much fun watching this film, I had to watch it a second time. And I will undoubtedly go see this one in the theater. Because as many of you know, when I truly love a film and I want to support a film, I will go spend money and see it in the theater, even after I've watched on a screening link or been to a press screening. Scared to Death is a simple premise. It melds worlds as we meet Jasper, a young filmmaker working as a PA, to a bitch for a boss director, and he seizes a chance to direct when his crew attends a seance in a haunted abandoned orphanage. Trapped inside, they're haunted by ghostly orphans and a sinister force. Now, for my money, when I started out in the industry over 40 years ago, I was working as a PA on sets. I did a lot of music videos. I worked on a ton of Rick Springfield's music videos, among many other artists, but I did a bunch of those. So for me, I'm getting Paul's eye from music videos and the whole experience of being a PA. So, you know, I really connected with this, and I love haunted house films and horror. Now, a film within a film always bodes for fun, as do haunted houses and a terrific cast. And here we have a cast led by the one and only Lynn Shay as the bad bitch boss director. Along with Lynn is Kurt Diemer, who, what a revelation for me. He is fantastic. Kurt Diemer is one of the actors known as the Grog. Bill Moseley is in the mix as the weaselly realtor seance medium Felix, who Jasper makes a deal with to hold a seance for the cast and crew. Olivier Paris, this is a breakout performance for him as Jasper, and he is an actor you need to keep your eye on. I see a lot of good things for him in the future. B.J. Minor appears as actor Johnny, and Victoria Konofal is the quote-unquote well-known actor Lena, who stars in this film being directed by Lynn Shay's Max. Now, in this exclusive conversation, and yes, it's the entire hour, Paul dives deep, and I mean deep, into the making of this horror comedy, Scared to Death, which is a self-described love letter to horror movies, quote-unquote, that blends satire, absurdity, and genuine genre reverence. We explore how the film uses a haunted house movie within a movie setup to examine belief, fear, masks people wear, and the absurdities of Hollywood itself. Paul details the personal inspirations behind the story, including buying a supposedly haunted house once owned by Charlie Chaplin, which originally inspired this story. He also talks about the joyful collaboration with his cast and crew and the deliberate balance of scares, humor, and emotional undercurrents. We also unpack the film's visual and sonic language, from its iconic house location and master shot staging to its rhythmic editing and on-point sound design. And ultimately, Paul talks about discovering what he discovered in making this film, about trusting his instincts and letting a film evolve beyond what's written on the page. Now, as you'll hear, we're going to break down the visual grammar and Paul's work with cinematographer Stephen Poster, whose work all of you are well familiar with: Donnie Darko, Southland Tales, Mel Brooks' Life Stinks, Rocky V, although not the best Rocky, Next of Kin, Revenge of Kitty Galore, which is tons of fun in the Cats and Dogs series. If you haven't seen it, go see it. And so many more. And how the two of them together developed a color palette, the lenses used, framing, dutching, camera positioning, unique camera shots. There are some great shots with the camera flat on the floor, giving us a floor level POV of things. And how about Paul's work with editor Ed Shires, who just happens to be a drummer with an incredible sense of rhythm, something that comes in handy with editing. Plus, we talk about Misha Siegel's score and Kurt Diemer's end credit song, Scared to Death. He's one of the writers, and he performs it, which, and it's fantastic. And there happens to be a music video that just was released this week on Scared to Death. And you'll hear Paul talk about the location house in Altadena where the film was shot. It was the first home ever built in Altadena, and one of the only homes to survive the Altadena fires last year. You're also going to find out how that house lucked out and survived. And yes, Paul gets the entire show today. That's how much cinematic exploration we did in this interview. And it's also because he's a terrific guy and I love this film. So take a listen and enjoy as Paul Boyd discusses Scared to Death. Hey, Paul!
Hi, thank you so much. How's it going?
Oh, well, thank you so much. It's going great. How's it going for you?
I can't complain. I'm just having fun, you know, talking to everyone about the film. So it's good. I'm feeling excited for the release next week.
You know, how could you not have fun talking about Scared to Death? This film is so much fun. I so enjoyed myself watching this film, and I have to say a big part of it is two big parts. Lynn Shay, number one, she gets to be a bitchy badass. Normally, we don't see her that mean. Yep. So that was a fun, unexpected element of the film. But then Kurt Diemer, that man has so much heart, is so grounded. He is the voice of reason in this film, and such a joy to watch as the Grog.
Oh man, he's gonna love to hear that. And me too. You know, that's the thing about Kurt is, you know, because Kurt is also, you know, the investor and the financier, the executive producer of the movie, and he's a traveling musician. He's musician, actor. He does the whole thing, but he's relatively new in getting into it. The thing is about him, Kurt is the Grog. That's not hair and makeup. That's his real beard. Those are his clothes. Like and when we started putting it together and figuring out, okay, how do we incorporate him the right way? He's just that guy. And I'm like, you just don't act. I'm just going to film and just be you. And that's what he did. And I think that's why that comes across, because that's what he's really like. He's just this lovable, smart, fun, you know what I mean, but very grounded. And, you know, he's built his own business from the ground up. You know, he was inspirational. And I'm glad you picked up on that. Really, truly means that, you know, we did something right there.
He is so genuine. There is not a false note in his performance. And he is the guy, if I were putting together a film, the character of the Grog, I would want him, if for no other reason, because of his authenticity and how genuine he is and how much he cares. That's something right. that really stands out. Everybody in this film, they all have their own agendas.
Yep.
Except for the Grog. The Grog wants to do a good job. He wants to care about his fellow actors. People are freaking out. He's like, guys, look, it's not legit. You know, this is not a real seance. We don't have ghosts here. No matter how bad things get, he tries to right the ship, so to speak.
He does. He does. And you know, it's interesting because he's the one that has the most experience, right? Because even, you know, people love him, like Felix, and then Jasper's like, yeah, he's been in 200 movies.
Yeah.
But the thing about the Grog is that he is in bliss. He loves the business. He has joy, and he makes joy because he loves to make movies. And because the film is a love letter to horror movies, mm-hmm. you know, that's what the meant to be. That's why it has every trope in the book. You know, the orphans, the thing. You know, we played into that and tried to kind of make something that's satirical and funny and a little absurdist. I mean, you know, we weren't afraid of going that way, especially with Lynn, because in the beginning, as you said, you know, so smartly, is that she is an unusual role for her because she usually plays the medium. And that was what I cast her as. And she goes, I don't want to play the medium. She goes, I want to play the horrible boss. I want to go there and really. And I'm like, and I was so happy because the films I remember her from are Something About Mary, Kingpin, you know, where she does these outrageous performances that are comedic.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, the whole Insidious thing is the biggest franchise in horror, but that's where I remember her from. Those are my memories of Lynn. So when that all shifted, I was like, okay, we really have to lean into the comedy. And that was why working with the Grog was kind of, he's the comic relief too, because he's always saying that line, oh, this reminds me of a movie that I was in. And he says it every time. And that's part of the joke, but part of the reverence of what the Grog represents, which is the love of the industry. And that's where I am. You know what I mean? That's my feeling, is I come from that, you know, and I've been making films since I was 13, but I have this like love of the business and a reverence for it. And I tried to put that into that character.
You've done so well with the casting and with the appropriateness of it. That's the word, the appropriateness of it, Paul. But yeah, I mean, Lynn is just, she's fantastic. And like you, I remember Lynn from her pre-Insidious days.
Yep.
And even since then, she did one film, Room for Rent, where she played the landlady. And she kept trying to doll herself up to look 30 years younger to entice the boy she's renting a room to. Just, she has a great comedic bent. But everyone forgets that. And
Well, not me. Like, I that was why when that shift happened. Because there's nothing really funny about obviously the way Bill Moseley played Felix, he brought the comedy to it. Because, you know, Bill just has that innate ability to feel very untrustworthy. He's got that glint in his eye. He's got the scorpion on his neck. Like, he's the real joker. You know, he's the kind of the trickster. And that was a different role for him, too, because he usually plays the monster. And in the end of the film, it transpires that happens. But it was a different role for him and for Lynn, you know, in the modern optics. So that was exciting for me. I'm like, great, I get to kind of flip these characters a little and give people something that they haven't seen for a minute.
You really did. And it's so rare that directors will think outside the box like that and let an actor go somewhere that they are, you know, not known for. And I think you get your better...
Isn't that the thing with the actors act? If you're a good actor, you know, they so often get pigeonholed, right?
Yes.
So, well, that's what they... And that's the same for directors, too. You know, we all get pigeonholed. And to me, if you have the skill and the ability to act, you can do anything. And that's the fun for me. I'm not stuck in one genre of horror. I make dramas and comedies. Like, you know, I love mixing it up. And the way that I work with actors is that I see this, when you make a film, there's three films. There's the film you write, because I write too, I'm a director, but the film you write, the film you shoot, and the film you end up with. It's kind of, my process is like that. So when I work with actors, I want them to improvise. I want them to bring the character to life with words and nuances that I don't even want to think about, because that's their job. You know, I'm trying to write for women, men, kids, monsters. You know, I really cherish actors that are willing to kind of bring ideas to the table. And that's what Lynn did. She ended up writing pretty much most of her dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were working with her a couple of years before we went into production. So she got very involved in also the story. We had very neat bows tied at the end of the story where she was an orphan at the school, at the thing, and Bill was reincarnated. We had all these loose ends tied up, and she's like, no. Keep it open, let people use their imagination, let people think about it. And, you know, she's just wise in that aspect of having been in the business so long. She has a really innate grip of story, in my opinion.
Yeah, and she's very intuitive. It's like she can see ahead. You know, she looks at the totality of the circumstances and has almost an omniscience about what is coming down the road or what the possibilities are. And it works really well in this film because it is open-ended. We're not going to give anything away, but it is open-ended as to who some of these characters actually are.
Yep.
Which begs... Go ahead, Paul.
And that's true. That's well observed because it's all about the fact that we wear masks, you know, in real life and in Hollywood, right? And the film is a process of kind of unmasking who these people are, because that's what happens when you confront in a fearful situation, like the real truth comes out. So it's kind of about that too. But well observed.
But this begs the question, where did the idea for this film arise? Did you just sit down there one night after a hard day, kick back with a lager or something and say, hey, you know, this would be a good movie? Or did you do it over breakfast in the morning? You were bored because cereal boxes have nothing to read anymore on them.
I remember reading the boxes when I was a kid. You know, the origin of this story comes from real life. Okay, so about 25 years ago, I bought my first house. I bought a house for the first time in Hollywood, and this house was originally owned by Charlie Chaplin.
Ooh.
And it was 1911 Craftsman. So anyway, it needed a lot of fixing up. So anyway, we bought this house from the owner directly. There was no realtor.
Mm-hmm.
And then this guy was a funny old, trippy old guy, an old actor. And he, the day before we moved in, he says, by the way, this house is haunted. And he says that in the 30s, it was a bordello, and there was a prostitute here called Mary, and she was killed, and she wanders the house at night. And of course, they're meant to disclose that before you buy that.
Yeah.
Being a non-believer, not a non-believer because I'm ignorant, but just I grew up in Scotland, you know, where witches and warlocks and myths are just the norm.
Mm-hmm.
So I grew up with the supernatural. So, you know, when I moved into the house, but I've never seen a ghost. It doesn't mean I don't believe that. It's the same as UFOs. You know, I've never seen one, but they could exist. I'm on the fence. I don't know to claim. But when we moved into the house, they all saw ghosts. Now, I never did. So in the middle of the night, I'd have to have a pee, and I'd be like looking in the mirror going, is this fucking thing going to appear behind me? You know, I would be just afraid to get out of bed in the middle of the night. And so we would talk about this, and I came up with this concept of believing is seeing. You know, whatever you believe, it's going to manifest into reality in some way. And you know, that's the same for people that don't believe. You almost shut these doors inside your mind of the potentiality of the human experience. So that became the concept for the film is, let's talk about that. Let's get in. And that's why in the film, Champ talks about that, the cerebral cortex. The brain is what really sees, not the eyes. So underneath it all, it came from a real experience. And we lived in an old house just like that. And because they say write about what you know, I figured, you know, like living in oblivion, let's put a group of filmmakers together who are all kind of on their own ego trip. And because that's a world I know, that's a dynamic and a paradigm that I understand, that group dynamics. And it works all the way through the film because they don't abandon each other. They stay as a community all the way through to the end. You know, they question each other and they get into arguments, but they're still a team.
Mm-hmm.
And they try to all the way through. And, you know, so that was part of it.
I just think it is so creative. And then the way you expand on this with the story and give us this legacy about it was an orphanage and the headlines were scared to death when five children were found scared to death in the attic. And it was never resolved as to the owner who was running this place. What happened? All anyone knows is it's been abandoned all these years. And
you get glimpses, you get kind of memory flashbacks, but it's never fully resolved. You're given clues as to what's going on, but it's not beaten over the head.
No, we go in there, and number one, this is one of those films, you know, in real estate, it's all about location, location, location. Well, the same thing applies to movies, and especially horror movies with a haunted house. This house is perfection, Paul. This is perfection. And it had to be a joy for you and your DP, for Steve, to shoot in this house, because you've got staircases, you've got hallways, narrow hallways, you've got a big area space in like what would be the main living room, you have landings. This is perfect for staging, setting up negative space, for getting some really good Dutch angles and even camera lens to the floor angles, and just fantastic. Fantastic. So the house is so key here. And I understand this is one of the few homes that survived the fires in Altadena.
Correct. First house built in Altadena. And during the fires, most of the houses around burned down. There's a fire station right next to the house. Literally in the backyard, there's a fire station.
Wow.
So the house survived. It got a little scorched, but it survived. Let me tell you about this house. My producer, Eric Barrett, who I've been with for 30 years, he found the house. And he lives out that way. So I'm like, the only reason you found this bloody house is because it's 5 minutes from yours. And we all have to drive from Hollywood to Altadena to make this movie. He goes, no, you're going to love this place. And I got there and I'm like, I haven't met, because I shot hundreds of music videos back in the day. And when I arrived at this house, I was like, I've been here before. I scouted this house for a shoot that never happened. So then I remember, it kind of clicked in my brain. So we went in. Every room that was in the script was in the house, the basement, the attic, the bathroom. When we got there and we were walking, we couldn't believe our eyes that everything was there. And every prop, apart from the ones that we made for the film specific, was in the house. All the furniture, it was just ready to go. And they'd shot a ton of horror movies. I think they even did an American Horror Story season in that house. And to me, that is okay, because this is a film crew looking for a horror house for a movie. They would do exactly what we did. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So in my mind, I was like, it doesn't matter that it's been used a million times, because I'm going to shoot it in a way that it hasn't been seen before. And working with Stephen Foster, the DP, you know, Donnie Darko, I mean, the guy's a genius. He, older guy, him and Jim Planet, my gaffer. I mean, the gaffer, Young Frankenstein, Traffic. I mean, the most incredible, those two guys, it was like having Gandalf and Dumbledore on the But really, these two wizards who just got it and knew how to do it. And obviously, it was a 20-day shoot. We had to move really fast. And these guys just nailed it. And I shot the film as a lot of master shots with everyone in the scene at the same time, you know, four or five people, rather than just close-ups of everyone. I wanted it to have a wider, more cinematic look to it. And I think we managed to achieve that. It's a little different than how most horror movies are, lots of close-ups. So this film is, as you said, the house is another character, really, and because it plays into that. The environment is important.
Yeah, and I love the wood. The wood in the house, it adds so much richness and texture to a film like this. So you feel that you walk into that house with all of the wood and the balustrades and the staircases and the flooring and the walls in wood. And you immediately, it feels lived in, like the past is still alive.
Totally. Well said.
So
buildings do that, right?
Yes.
The walls of buildings, they hold resonance, you know, and memories and all that. And I think it's really whether or not you're tuned into the frequency is how I see it with ghosts and all that. You know, if you're tuned in, you know, because our eyes, look at dogs. Dogs can see things that we can't see clearly. So there are things that we can't see that are right in front of us. Obviously, the human eye is developed in such a way that it protects the brain by not showing everything that's there. I mean, including ultraviolet light. So that's fascinating to me. Like, the science behind that. You know, I have a whole film about sleep paralysis and ghosts and nightmares. I'm fascinated by the science of it, because that's the blur of the line. Because I also believe where there's smoke, there's fire. You know, heaven and hell and all that. You know, it sounds so fantastical, but, you know, it's interesting. You know, anyone that claims to know the truth, you know what I mean? That's the exploration. And even wrapped within this kind of absurdist comedic jacket, it's still underneath it all, there's a subtext.
Yes.
It's kind of a deeper search, really. And whether people pick up on that, it doesn't really matter. It's like, that's what I'm about.
I think with any horror movie, especially a haunting one like this, with a seance involved, and you're trying to speak to the other side, there, that's always an undercurrent of potential truth that isn't, that's not just there to be a trope or a foil, a comedic foil or something to build upon.
Yeah.
And the fact that you create this seance and we've got five people, the pentagram, has 5 points, 5 participants, five dead kids in the past from the orphanage. So you bring in all this symbolism that is rooted in supernatural history.
Correct.
So, you know, that shows, number one, it shows good thought on your part, Paul, but it also adds another layer to the storytelling.
Yeah.
And you pick up on all of that with your visuals, such as the pentagram, your use of red. And this is where Stephen is just so perfect. I have loved Stephen's work as a DP, going back to his early days of Blood Beach and Dead and Buried. But then, you know, what he did for Richard Kelly with I love Southland Tales more than Donnie Darko. I will admit to that.
Yeah, no, it's beautiful. Photographically, yeah.
Yes.
I agree.
And
he did Second Unit on Close Encounters. I mean, think about that. You know, up against with Spielberg, like all that time ago when he was a young man, doing all the Second Unit, the potato mountain inside the house. Like, he would just blow my mind. I was a little teenager watching that movie, you know, having my mind blown. And then you get to work with a guy that set the lights. Like Jim Planet, too, the gaffer. I mean, his dad did It's a Wonderful Life. Do you know what I mean? In High Noon. And this guy's on the set with us. So to me, that is really what it's all about, I think, is, you know, there's so many, and that's kind of, the film's about that too, you know, it's about old and new, it's about the, you know, it's about the approach, like Max represents the old world of Hollywood, the hierarchy and the bully, I mean, swimming with sharks, you know, this kind of, the stereotype of the angry, you know, the angry person that's successful but just is miserable, and that's because of generational trauma. That is ultimately what's going on in this film. You know, something happened to Max, something's happened to these kids, the abusive father, you know, the kids with missing parents. It's all, in the end, it's ultimately all about that. You know, I grew up without a dad, so that creeps into everything that I
write
in the most subconscious way. You know, I write all different kinds of things, but those kind of themes, family, end up working, you know, into most of my projects.
You know, and I just think it's fantastic. But, you know, bringing in Stephen, any man that can do work with Mel Brooks and do Life Stinks, do Southland Tales and Donnie Darko with Richard, do something like Dead and Buried, or even Rocky V, even though it's not one of the better ones, no fault of his. And Cats and Revenge of Kitty Galore? Come on.
I know.
This is the guy you needed on this film.
I know. And I met him years before. You know, I met him with a bunch of cinematographers, with Tom Richmond and Daniel Pearl. We were all together. And the first time I met him, and I remember having a long conversation with him. And then when it came to put it, because the thing is, for the last 20 years, I've shot all my own work. I kind of work as a director DP, but for the film, I knew, you know, I have to sit back and really bring in someone that's going to know more than me, teach me, and let me focus on directing. And my producer knew Stephen very well because his son, my producer's son, Noah, was at Art Center, and Stephen was a professor over there, so they had the relationship. So Noah, the student, ended up firsting the movie for Stephen because, you know, we're working with Noah and training him up. And now he just shot the film I did last year, and Stephen kind of mentored him for that, but he DP'd it. So Stephen, it just connected, like all the family knew him. And then it was a tiny little movie, and he met us, and he was just so enthusiastic and wanting to do a good job and do something different. And he brought in Canon, who hooked us up with all the cameras and the lenses. It was that's why we made him an executive producer, because he just brought so much to the table, you know, production wise, with his, you know, people that wanted to work with him on the crew. Everyone gave us good deals, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And then Noah Dietz, the first AC, my producer son, got to kind of have a big responsibility, you know, in a movie under a huge DP like Steven. So it was great. A lot of gratitude going on.
So I'm curious, you had the script done, you've got your location. How did you and Steven go about developing the visual grammar here? Because number one, as you said, it is cinematic, because you do a lot of masters. But especially when we get into the attic with specifics and particulars, or when we have dolls' heads rolling down hallways and or popping up, or heads coming up in bathtubs or something, you make really judicious use of ECUs, but you use them where they're important. We get a lot of, in the third act, we get a lot of close-ups on faces. Faces are so important for the fear factor. So I'm curious, and because of so many of the effects that are happening throughout the film, many of which I'm sure are practical and in camera, others that may have a little enhancement in post. But how did you two go about developing your visual grammar for this film?
I storyboarded the whole film. You know, I filled two books up with probably 150 pages of storyboards, because that's how I work. Is, you know, so interesting. Werner Herzog says, you know, storyboards are for cowards. And it's so funny, because it's kind of true. In a way, the real big decision should be made on set when the actors have done the walkthrough and you've seen it in situ and you know the lighting. That's when the final decision should be made, because only when you're there in the moment can you determine what's the best approach, because everything changes. Nuances change. I shouldn't move this way, I should move that way. So what I do, my part of my method, is I'll storyboard the entire film, every camera angle. And that every angle that's in the board is in the film. So I'll detail the storyboards, I mean, over extensively, just but chicken scratch. I mean, my own drawings and my own book, nothing. You know, we don't hire a storyboard artist. I just do it as a kind of means of camera direction and for editing. Because, you know, if you have a grasp on how to edit to build tension, you got to work that into production. You don't just leave that to the edit bay.
That's
you have
right.
to do the cover in order to. So I did the storyboards and then went over to Steven, and we walked through the storyboards with the script for a few days. This is months before. And then we did camera tests. And then when we got on set, I didn't pull the storyboards out, because I already inherently knew how to cover it, because I'd done the drawings on the set. Steven and I would just look at the setup and say, okay, how do you want to start? And da, da, da. But also, to save time, we had three cameras.
Oh, wow.
And a lot of the times when we were around the table, we were shooting with three cameras, because that was the only way we could have done it in the amount of time, because we didn't have extensive rehearsals, so there was a lot of improv on set. I mean, it was a true indie film where, you know, but as we moved through the days, it just, we got faster and everyone got in the flow, and then it all just unraveled in a positive way. You know, the energy was good. So
how did
I think it's good to go in over prepared and then on set be more rock and roll.
Absolutely. I love the color palette. I love your color palette. So often with horror films, as you well know, they'll go really deep into super saturation, or everything will be consumed with red or orangey reds for fire, hell, the devil, whatever. How did you decide on the color palette? Because it is so, it's slightly heightened in the living areas, but it's very realistic. And your real differential is between the living room area and upstairs in the attic, which, of course, the attic should be, quote unquote, more subdued than the rest of the house. So I'm curious, because I love the color palette.
Yeah, well, you know, the thing is, when we chose the house, we knew that our background color for the most part was going to be wood, right? So, and that was good because it allowed us to kind of, I did, you know, I wanted to see everybody. What I didn't want to do was try and create some dark, scary Blumhouse type of like walking through a creepy house with cobwebs. That's not this film. This film is visualized more general because it's not just a horror. It leans more into comedy, I think, than horror. So, I mean, it's wrapped in a horror jacket. It's a pastiche, it's a satire. So, to me, once we got inside and we saw that we were dealing with mostly mid-tones of these dark browns, and that determined the palette. And that was, I was very involved in the costuming too, with, you know, keeping most people in black and then just having, you know, Felix in his color, which is a red. And, you know, he has a scorpion on his neck. It's so obvious what's going on to me when I look at his clothing. Like, not to trust this, like, carny type of, you know. But you love him because he loves the grog. See, that's the thing. You know, I think with every villain too, you know, you have to be able to associate to the villain and understand where they're coming from. You know, that humanizes everyone a little. And so that was part of that. But no, it was definitely designed, like, with regards to the clothing, and also knowing that we had a dark environment allowed us to kind of focus on lighting the people and seeing the faces and not making this dark, obscure. That's why we did them in masters, because I wanted it to have a more classical look and feel to it, you know, almost like Clue. I wasn't trying to make, you know, I was trying to lean more into the kind of suspense, you know, and that's what this film is. Hitchcock, it's the bomb under the table, right? It's like, you know, something, it's triggered in the beginning, you're given the clues, and then you're just waiting for it to happen. Like The Shining. Oh, the last guy who was here chopped up his wife. Oh, that's not going to happen to me. And then you're just waiting for it to happen. So that device is used in this film too. So it kind of leans more into that. And that's why there's a lot of parallel cutting of different scenes happening at the same time to kind of build the tension. Because you know eventually it's going to explode. It's not just a sequence of grisly murders
No.
and people being in terror. It's more them trying to solve a puzzle and then coming to the realization that the shit is real, but still not really believing it.
Yeah.
Even at the end of the film, you know, the line that Grock said, you know, it's just kind of, you know, I don't want to give too much away, but that we I wanted to walk that line of, is this real? Is it not? Even within the way it's visualized, I wanted it to be heightened and a little fantastic, and, you know, with Lynn and her makeup, and, you know, I wanted it to be, you know, lean into a little bit of Evil Dead that way, where it's kind of, it's a bit silly. You know, I wanted it to be a little silly and a little absurd, just because, you know, that's what makes it funny to me. That's what the film business is. It's just a little absurd, you know.
And it has to be. You were supposed to suspend disbelief and just enjoy yourself. Now, you brought up a very important thing, Lynn's makeup. Oh my God. That makeup, the most fantastic makeup I have ever seen done on Lynn, one of my favorite makeup jobs of a horror film. That
We really pushed it.
who did that makeup? Was it Andrea Lee or was it Rachel Olson who was the makeup?
Rachel, yeah,
Rachel did it.
Rachel, yeah, who I've worked with for years. I mean, we had a team, we had six people in hair and makeup, but Rachel led it, and as we did tests before. But, you know, it was one of those things where we had it one way on set, and then we enhanced it in post as she devolves. We kind of we enhanced it, but we did it in a fearless way. It was like, no, we can be a little over the top because the whole film's a little over the top. So I wasn't afraid of realism. You know, this isn't a documentary. Do you know what I mean? It's not like Paranormal Activity. You know, this is heightened, silly, comedic, you know, fun. I wanted it to be fun. And I think, you know, the more you lean into the kind of the wild design and the outrageous in this context, you know, makes it, you know, just heightens it a little.
Yeah, that little bit of absurdity keeps you on your toes as to whether is this real, is it not? So we're kind of going along with the grog of folks, this is fake, this is, you know, this isn't real, this has got to be a setup, and just chill. So
Yep.
to see the bit of absurdity. But and I do have to say, you mentioned costuming and the makeup done on Lynn with the grays that are in that base that's on her in full makeup looks spectacular against her black leather jacket. Spectacular.
And she, and again with Lynn's clothing, we, 'cause see, Lynn is so, she's so cool in her own way. Like, those are her clothes. Like, she, that's the thing about her. She's just got style. You know what I mean? She may be 80, but she's like 30. You know, she just has this zest to her and this youthfulness, and even in her fashion. So we were looking through, I was looking through all her clothes, and I'm like, yeah, let's do that. Let's do this. And it also grounded her because she felt more like herself. You know, she wasn't stretching to play. I mean, obviously, it's a super extreme version, but she put a lot of herself into it with the identity of the character and felt confident in her own clothes. And this character needed to feel confident. And I just think that's more fun. Look, you know, that was what this was about for her. She said, I want to have fun with it. You know, it wasn't about, I want a bigger role. She wanted to have fun and get her
Yeah.
teeth into it, and you know, and thank goodness, you know, because that, in my opinion, is what she's so great at.
Yep. And I completely agree. Now, the editing on this, I love the editing on this, Paul. Ed Shears does your editing. This is so well done where we have, we're in the living room, they're talking, they're saying something. Felix is spinning some kind of yarn about the history and the seance and the process, and then we're cutting upstairs. We hear a sound. This is where your sound is so perfectly in tune with your visual edit, but I love the editing and the intricacy of it with everything that unfolds, giving us those breadcrumbs as to the history of the building. How challenging was this editing process, Paul?
I can't tell you how hard it was. It wasn't hard. It was just took time because remember, as I said going in, you know, it's kind of a hybrid, this movie. It shifted more into comedy. So when we got into the edit, it was like, okay, we have to really figure this dance, this balance between the scares and the funny. And it became like a challenge because I don't claim to be a master of comedy or horror, and they're two of the hardest mediums to get right, you know, because there's, but you know, comedy and horror are kind of the same thing, overcoming circumstances, you know, they're very similar emotionally, which is why I think they work well together. But no, my editor Ed, he's a drummer, and he has like this rhythm and this cadence that I've worked with a lot of drum, it's only for music videos. A lot of my editors in the past were drummers, funnily enough. So it felt natural when I worked with Dave Stewart from the Eurythmics for years, as his head of production, and we brought in Ed as an editor, and then we just hit it off, and that was about 15, 16 years ago. So I trained him up initially, and he has now edited four movies for me, and he's, you know, he's from Britain. We have a very kind of similar, you know, sense of humor. But he's just studious, and you know, he does the work. He's not afraid of putting in the time and grinding, and also going back and changing things and re, you know, a lot of people get stuck. It's like temp love. You put a cut together, you go, I want it to stay like that. He's not pressure, very open to retooling, and you know, because films are, and a lot of people say films are made in the editing. It's kind of true. I mean, you know, it's definitely in my world. You know, we make the film on set, but we really shape it and create it in the edit. So he's a great collaborator, and I love him and his wife. You know, we're like great friends. And you know, obviously my producer I've worked with for 30 years. So we have this like, it really is like a family. Do you know what I mean? We're very, all very close, and I feel very lucky that I don't just have to sit in a room with an editor who's an editor that I don't have a relationship with, because films are fucking emotional. Do you know what I mean? They're especially as a writer director, man, it's such an emotional experience for me. But I try not to be overtly precious or overly micromanage. I just kind of hire people and try and get them to do their best, you know, because otherwise, you know, when I was younger making music videos and commercials, I micromanaged everything. I thought it was about my vision. And, you know, you slowly learn that, no, it's 20 brains are better than one. Period. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of my philosophy on it. So when I hire someone now, I just want them to do what they do and get their rocks off. And then usually that works out.
Well, you know, one of the things I love about the about Ed's editing and about you doing a film like this is with your music video background, because you go back decades to the more frenetic kinds of, because I worked on a number of music videos back in the 80s, and it was much more frenetic in the 80s and 90s in terms of energy, in terms of cuts, a lot of rapid fire, cut, cut, cut. As you're putting things together, and all to the beat of music. Mm-hmm. And I know some editors who are also drummers. So it makes perfect sense to me why you work with Ed. But I think that is what makes you a better director, a better filmmaker for this particular film, for Scared to Death, because of your own, not just Ed's rhythmic sense, but because of where you come from and the work that you've done for decades with those music vids and the very nature of what they are. Anybody that looks at those Shania Twain videos, it's like you feel it, you see it, and I feel and see that here with Scared to Death, that rhythmic sensibility of the edit.
Definitely. I mean, the rhythm and pacing and tempo is so important. You know, music and film, they're kind of the same thing, you know, in a way. But, you know, I really appreciate you saying that, because, you know, we take our job seriously. Do you know, we don't just go in the edit and go, yeah, whatever, that works. Like, we kill ourselves in the edit, like, going over things. Is this right? Is that right? You know, we really lift every stone. And we do that when we're filming, too, because we love what we do. This is not a job. This is a process. This is like going on an exploration or going to the North Pole, or, you know what I mean? So we love it, and put our due diligence is in, you know, we put the work in, and that's the people that I work with. They're all like that. They all just want to work hard and make great art. And, you know, talking to someone like yourself who can see it and get it and feel it is just so rewarding. And even if it's just one person, because, you know, when I make films, like every filmmaker, I think, they make them for themselves. You know what I mean? I'm not sitting there going, what would the audience think? I mean, when we're putting in music and stuff, we're thinking that. But in the beginning, I'm thinking, what do I want to do? What story do I want to tell? Yeah. Is this going to appeal to my sensibility? Otherwise, it has to come from that personal, emotional place in order for me to even validate taking the time to put it down on paper. That takes a long time. The amount of time it took to get this film made, we're talking almost a decade. And we've done other things in between, but we just never gave up on it. We were like, you know, we're going to make this film, and never giving up and always working hard. And then eventually putting the pieces of the puzzle together, Lynn, you know, Bill, and then it changing shape, and then suddenly people understanding it better. You know, so I think that's the big lesson here, is that it's important not to just get stuck. It's stuck in a moment with an idea. It's like it can evolve, it can get better, it can always get better, it can always change. Sometimes things have to do that in order to come to life. You may think you have something great, but there could be something missing, or, do you know what I mean? That's the mystery of it to me. Mm-hmm. I was talking about this before to a friend. I'm like, what is it that makes some films universally loved? Like, what is that that just makes a film hit everyone? And, you know, that fascinates me, like, because I'm into storytelling and the power of storytelling and what stories mean, you know, and how they can affect us. And that's part of my goal, not for success and fame, but how do you put out a message that everyone gets to hear and feel? That's really ultimately what it's all about, and, you know.
And I do have to mention, people, this is a film where you want to listen to the dialogue, too. Because you have some real gems in here, whether stuff was scripted or whether it was ad-libbed. Because there's one point in the film in the third act where someone is calling 911. Because we got a seance situation here. We need some help. And they're put on hold. And your sound edit and mix is so good that as this person is moving through the house, surveying things that are happening, you hear the music, and then it keeps saying, "Please don't hang up. We'll be with you shortly." And I was roaring. And that, I mean, people actually complain about that in real life, where they call 911 and they've been put on hold.
That's why it's in there. Oh my God. The irony. That's the absurdist, where it's kind of, it reflects real world. It's the cliche.
Yeah.
But, you get cliche on the nose in the right situation, then you've got comedic gold. I mean, that's, Mel Brooks. I mean, do you know what I mean? You mentioned Mel Brooks with, I look at Mel Brooks' films and think, how do you do that? How can you be so funny? You know what I mean? That inspires me. That doesn't make me go, I'll never be like Mel Brooks. That makes me go, how do you do that? It's fascinating to me.
You have touches like that, but that in particular, I was just roaring during that entire sequence. Music is also a big part here. I love the score that Misha Siegel has done. Mm-hmm. It's appropriate for a horror film. It's also appropriate for a comedy. There's a nice musicality that blends here. And then we get into the end. I gotta say, the end credit song, Scared to Death, that Kurt did. Wow. Yeah. That is so fantastic.
Yeah. We shot a video in the house a couple of months ago that's just out now, where I put him in the band in the same house, and I brought in the Walking Dead team and turned them all into zombies, and they're like playing the song in the house, intercut with the movie. So, no, he's great. And that's the thing about Kurt. He's the whole package. When it comes to his music, it's not like that's like a side project. He takes the whole thing seriously. And check this out. His new album that's coming out is called A Grog Is Born. So he's now taking the grog and putting it into his musical career. Which, that's like Rob Zombie. That's Alice Cooper. And that's what he is. That's where he should be. He's that good. And I keep telling him, in time, that's what's going to happen. And he has such an awareness of how to build his brand and how to put everything together and just focus it. And he's fearless, and the next thing we're doing together is outrageous. It's like really going to push him to the limit. And we just did a film last year called Relapse, and he's in that too. He did a great job, and that's a drama. So, we're just trying to kind of just do things a little differently. That's the thing. I love John Waters. To me, I want to make I don't know whether I'll ever make a big Hollywood movie. To me, I only want to make the films that I write, and I want to make unique, a different film every time. I know that's a challenge because, as I said, we get pigeonholed, but do you know what I mean? To me, it's the same way that music videos that you hit on earlier were a sketchbook for me, really, to learn technique. As you talked about editing, I learned so much from using music videos as a technique to learn technique on every aspect, visual effects, set design, lighting, shooting on location. The whole gamut. And things that I've learned come into play, when making a film.
Well, I know I'm looking forward to your next film of Relapse. Besides Kurt, one of my all-time favorite, Danny Houston. You've got Danny in there. You've got Xander Berkeley in there. Alex Winter. You're working with Lynn again. And Olivier, does a beautiful job.
And BJ.
Yeah. I have to say, Olivier Paris in Scared to Death, he is a character to watch. He is an actor to watch. Playing Lin Shaye as the film within the film, as the director Max, playing her PA.
Yeah.
He is... real, it's a very interesting character in this film.
Talented young man. He plays a good part in Relapse too. And I met probably 100 actors for that role. And he did a self tape, and within a minute I was like, that's him. And it's interesting. I was let's meet in this French restaurant. And he comes, and we meet in this French restaurant in I thought you'd like that, Olivier Paris. I meet him, he goes, I'm not French, I'm Italian. I was like, okay, you're Italian, you know. So, but he, to me, he's like a young De Niro. Like, and I mean that. He has this edge. He's got this look to him. You really feel for him. He's not, you know, he's not cold. He's got like an openness and a warmth. And I love that kid, man. He really, you know, I have high hopes for Olivier, really.
Well, I have to say, what's really interesting, you mentioned he's got different looks to him. We see him through most of the film. We get into the third act to near the end. Looks like a totally different guy. Different guy, because, with the wardrobe change, hair, the posture.
Because now he's haunted, right? In a way, he's been affected by what happened in the house, which shows that he has complexity. But also, you know, the reward, which we don't have to give away now, but, you know, in the end, you're left with that little twist where it's kind of like, what? What? You know, during that final scene. So it adds a little bit more dimension to his character where you start questioning him. Because the whole film, you never question him at all. And then right at the end, because of the, you know, the police and all that, you start to, you know, you just leave it with a little Easter egg is all that is. But, you know, and that's what I love about that kid. He you know, and that's just one tiny demonstration of it in the film at the end. But he has that to him, and he has dimension, and in Relapse, he really shows it. He's wonderful in it. So I hope I get to continue making movies with that kid.
Well, I can't wait to see Relapse. One thing that I want everybody to be aware of with Scared to Death is they have to watch this to the bitter, bitter end. Your end credits. Besides Kurt's great song that he wrote, he sings, the end credits are fantastic. Just populated with one movie poster after another that are all hilarious. I think I laughed the hardest at one, The Big Broccoli. That was great. But at the
which he mentions at one point in the film.
Yeah, I just...
And that's the thing. All those posters symbolize the different films that he talks about during the film. You know, he's like, oh, this reminds me of the movie. But, and that was, again, just to kind of put an easy... You know, a lot of people will leave the theater by then. You know what I mean? It comes like a minute into the credits. But it's just that Easter egg. And it just, it's showing how the whole sphere around the character is going to continue beyond this film. That's kind of what that's about. And the fake history is funny. You know, like Blair Witch, remember the great this is real. Like, that just does poking fun at that. And, you know, it's obviously AI. You know, that's poking fun.
I fell in love with all of them. You know, the artwork is fantastic for every single one. The titles are so creative. Robo Grog, Count Grogula, House of 1,000 Grogs. I mean, just fantastic. The womanizer was but everybody has to see that.
We had so much fun designing and making those, I'm telling you. And we didn't really tell him too. When we showed that to him, he was so touched, you know, because we kind of, the editor and I, and that's the other thing about Ed, he doesn't just edit, he does VFX tracking. So much work that, I mean, we worked with an amazing post house called Flawless. But Ed, in the same in Relapse, he's masterful in post-production. And I better not say too much, because maybe other people are going to come and steal him from me.
Yeah, we don't want that to happen, Paul.
Forget everything I said.
I want your team kept intact. I want your team kept intact. But, you know, another reason people have to stay to the bitter end is because even after the final end credit, there's an audio. There's some audio that they will hear that will leave you wondering and may even send some chills up your spine. So you deliver from first frame to the very bitter, bitter end. On every level, Paul, this film, it is so much fun. It is so well done. It is cinematic. You have great performances, impeccably cast. I love it. I love it. But now, what did you, as a storyteller, because you are a storyteller, what did you learn about yourself in making Scared to Death that you can take forward into your future projects, besides bringing your cast and crew along with you?
Yeah, which I intend to do. No, what I learned was, you know, I try to be fearless. You know, I try to go into stuff and be open. And, you know, I went into post-production afraid, you know, thinking, God, you know, how do I understand? How do I get the balance right? You know, do we make it scary over? It seemed to be an insurmountable challenge to how to define the story and make it work, because it evolved through the process. And what I learned based on listening to you and other people that are responding so positively to the movie, it makes me go, yeah, well, I don't need to question myself so much. You got to trust your instinct, go with your gut, you know, and that is ultimately what I had to do in this, because at a certain point I lost not control of the reins, but I had to kind of really loosen my grip and let it evolve and become what it was meant to be. So that was a big learning curve, because as a writer, you want to have everything sorted out beforehand. Mm-hmm. But it's the same as storyboards in an aspect, in a certain way, I'm realizing now, where you do all the preparation, but then you go in and you try and improvise on the day, you know, based on all the experience. Because it's not just your storyboards that affect, it's your life experience, colors you've seen on a certain day, a certain sound you've heard when you've walked into a tunnel or into a smell, like all of those things affect every aspect of the film. Because I believe that as human beings, we're antenna. I feel like I'm an antenna. That's it. Just picking up frequencies, picking up stories, and somehow wanting to translate those through my own lens. It sounds so egotistical, but it's not about fame and success for me. It's just this urge, this compelled to want to, you know, share information.
Keep picking up those frequencies. That's all I got to say, Paul. Because I was a fan of your music videos anyway over the decades. So, and to see this, I love this film. Love this film. And I can't wait to see Relapse. And I hope when that comes around, we'll get to chat about that one too.
For sure. And you know what? I'll get you an early screener of it too, because I'd love to get your take on it, you know, because we're just finishing sound and everything now. So I'll make sure I get a copy over to you to check out.
Oh, God, I would really love that. And I will. And
super excited by it. And really, you know, it deals with social media and just fame and you know, the pressure that young girls are under. It's about fentanyl and overdosing. It's really intense, super intense film. So it's a straight drama. And, well, and Kurt did a great job.
And just telling me that much about it, it explains why Danny Houston and Xander Berkeley are perfect fits for this film.
Yeah, my producer, Eric, goes way back 30 years with those guys. You know, he was one of the producers on Sid and Nancy, and he was one of the best men at Danny's wedding. So he knows them both. And we brought Danny in for a film a few years ago, a COVID drama I made called We Are Gathered Here Today, and he collaborated on that, and which the whole movie was a Zoom call. So when it came to doing this, because it was a similar thing, he's on the end of a phone, he knew we could make it happen. And he bent over backwards to help us. It's just, you know, that right there, that kind of validation like that makes me go, okay, at least I think I'm doing the right thing. You know, but when you get actors of a certain caliber that are willing to collaborate on these tiny little projects, that just means a lot, you know?
Oh, absolutely. Well, Paul, I know Annie has you scheduled to jump off to somebody else here in about 90 seconds. Yeah. So this has been such a joy getting to speak with you and talk about film and Scared to Death, and I can't wait till we do it again.
I just so appreciate your enthusiasm and positivity. You know, in our business, there's so much competition and there's so many films. I mean, look at Sundance this year, 16,000 submissions.
Yeah.
You know, and makes you think, well, how can I possibly break on through to the other side? And, you know, and in the end, it's ultimately not about that. It's about, does the film work? Does it connect? And the fact, just sitting and listening to you, just, you know, it warms my heart. And I really appreciate you taking the time, you know. Thank you so much.
And Annie will vouch for it when I say, if it sucked, I would tell you that too.
I would hope so. Definitely.
And Annie's probably listening, laughing, because she knows I've done that before. During live interviews, no less.
Yeah, right. all about it.
Oh, Paul, thank you, thank you, thank you. And you go have a great rest of your day as we count down the days to the release of Scared to Death next week.
Oh, I can't wait. And I look forward to speaking to you in the future.
Absolutely. Thank you. Bye-bye. And that was writer-director Paul Boyd talking about Scared to Death, which is in theaters this coming Friday, March 13th. Friday the 13th, a perfect release date for a film with a haunted house. And as I said earlier and in the interview, keep your butts in the seats through the credits, because Paul has a real treat of extras in those end credits that are fantastic fun, not to mention Kurt Diemer's song, which is also a lot of fun. Before I go this week, I do have to give a big shout out to publicist Annie Jeeves, who's handling the PR for Scared to Death, for allowing me, actually asking me, to air this interview before the embargo. The press embargo lives later this week. I hope by hearing the interview now, it'll make some of you run to the theater this weekend to see the film. Especially if you don't want to watch the Oscars next Sunday. You know, the 15th, Ides of March, Oscars. I think you'd do better to probably go to the theater and see Scared to Death that next weekend. So, that's all the time we have today, and then some. So until next week, I'm Debbie Elias. This is Behind the Lens.